Good morning, everyone. Whether you're on that new year, new me train or just going with the flow, you are listening to episode 25 of Hidden Apron Radio with me, Paulo Espanola. And can I just say how great it is to be back here in New York City? I spent the last few weeks traveling the Iberian Peninsula from the island of Madeira to Barcelona. And while it was a blast, we are back with a brand new episode. So, it may be a new year, but you can bet that our show is staying the course. We are highlighting the unique stories of the people behind our food, their mindsets, and how all of us are connected through the meals we eat in often unseen but powerful ways. We interview everyone from chefs to farmers to grocery store owners, and if you've been a longtime listener of the show, you'll notice that not one guest has a story that's easy to fit into a box or a label. We've had a business student who's a rice trader, a banker turned farmer, and even a programmer turned coconut jerky maker. We on the show love stories that are beautifully messy, and tangents are entirely welcome here. This episode has been years in the making, if I say so myself, as I first met our guest, Allison Kopf, founder of AgriList, years ago at a food tech event. We reconnected at another conference not too long ago, and I'm especially excited about our conversation today because it is probably the closest melding of the two worlds I live in, my day job at an enterprise software company and my main hustle in the world of food. AgriList is a software that allows indoor farmers to analyze data that's pulled into their sensors, everything from temperature, light, carbon dioxide, into one integrated platform. This then allows them to bring more stability into their operations and subsequently increase revenue. You might think, wait, hold on. That's like a little too obvious of a solution, no? Like, aren't we already doing that? But not really. If you keep in mind that most farmers are still tracking things by hand without much data-driven analytics or are keeping data in separate silos, that most farms are barely profitable with very long investment horizons, and that we have massive food problems to fix in the coming years all around the globe, AgriList is a solution that is both necessary and timely, and everyone should give this a listen whether you're just, air quotes around just, a software engineer or a hardcore foodie. We totally geek out on this one, and I've included links in the show notes of all the jargon we throw around, both software and food. But give this one a listen, because besides talking about AgriList, and even if you didn't care about food, which I doubt since you're listening to the show, Allison's mindset is one we can all learn from. Trained as a physicist, she approaches problems with critical thought, and for those who hate inefficiencies, like myself, she says that the thing that gets her out of bed every day is the opportunity to fix inefficiencies. Especially nowadays when it's easy to fall into the trap of a sensationalist story or news bite, food or otherwise, people like Allison, who are able to take a look at data and apply principles from one field to food, provide a very refreshing conversation. We talk about identifying problems to fix and driving focus, creating magical products that people will love, why indoor farming is a thing, and how you can apply skills you've learned in one area of life to a seemingly disparate one. Again, whatever your background is, this one is worth listening to if you're interested in solving real problems in the world. So without further ado, my conversation with Allison Kopf. Allison, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited because this is the first episode that I'm doing that straddles like the two worlds that I live in of food and tech. It's usually like one or the other. So I know that I'm going to have the tendency to geek out over stuff. So I'm already keeping myself in check. But before we talk about the work, we should talk about the people behind the work. So first off, I wanted to get started with your road here. If you could talk about how you got into this space, because I know before this, right, we were talking about how you were in physics before this and you weren't really even looking into agriculture. So what was that road look like when you got into this indoor farming space?
Yeah, it's funny when I look back at my path, because I feel like to some degree you can look at it with one lens and say, oh yeah, that's completely rational. And then one other lens where it makes no sense at all. And so I studied physics in college and really was intrigued by problem solving. To me, the thing that I get out of bed for every morning is inefficiencies in systems. Mm-hmm. And physics was sort of the study of that. It was, how do you look at the systems in the world and try and make them more efficient, or try and understand them via more more formalized problem solving practices. And I loved that. It was, you know, you want to talk about geeking out, but that was the thing that I got really excited by. And I had the opportunity in college to actually work on a project called the Solar Decathlon, which was a 2-year project that involved colleges from all around the world. And you spend 2 years designing and building a solar powered house from scratch. And I loved it. This was my calling. Solar was really, really exciting at the time. There were really interesting things going on from a biological perspective and a nano perspective, and they were involving different technologies. And so from a physics kid's perspective, that's very cool. You can study light and how it affects things. And so I started working with a number of solar companies in the Bay Area. And then the industry in the late 2000s, or, you know, 2010-ish, 10 to 2011, started to really collapse upon itself because of the Chinese market flooding the U.S. with pricing. And a number of big high-profile companies sort of going under. And it made it really difficult for tech companies to secure that later growth financing. And so what I did was I moved back to New York and started looking for things that were similar. And I had 2 job offers on the table at the time. One was from a solar investment company, and one was from a startup called Bright Farms in New York that was building greenhouses in urban areas. And I took the solar investment company's offer, later to be convinced by the founder of Bright Farms to reject that offer and to join them and take the journey with them. And I remember sitting with my mother and saying, man, I don't know anything about tomatoes. I know nothing at all about growing produce.
This is exactly why I'm asking this question.
And I thought about it for a really long time, but the things that were exciting to me and I think are exciting to a lot of people in this space, you know, food. I think I like to eat. Yeah. A lot of people like to eat. And we all have to eat by nature. And so the agricultural system as a whole was really exciting to me because it's always going to exist and it's always going to have to grow. No pun intended. And so I was really intrigued by this space. And then from a technology perspective, the idea of controlling your environment and bringing in this idea of energy efficiency that I was used to, and trying to focus on the sustainable controlled environment growing where you could hedge against climate change and all these other factors, to me was this sort of perfect blend of things that I was used to and cared about and things I was really good at doing. So I did that. And then, you know, a few years later, 5 years later, I started a company called AgriList, and that's where we are today.
It seems like it wasn't just a trend for you where you're like, oh, let me go just try this agriculture thing. Was it the fundamental nature of food that drew you into this space? Because one could say, oh, why didn't you enter like the med tech industry, right?
That's yeah.
problem solving. Or was it the fact that like everyone's got to eat that kept you here?
Yeah, I think it's, you know what it is? It's, so I mentioned this earlier, but it's that idea that the system is incredibly inefficient. So it's, the food system as a whole is actually really, really efficient for a number of reasons, right? We get...
Efficient.
Okay. We get a lot of calories to people fast. And to a lot of people, right? In a lot of different areas. You can, I mean, the idea of a supermarket is insane. The fact that you can walk into a supermarket and buy food from any country in the world for pretty cheap is sort of insane.
And by the way, caveat, we're talking about the US system, right? Because
mostly. I
mean, some of the people who've been on here are like farmers in the Philippines who...
Oh, totally different. Right? Totally different. Yeah. And so the idea of a supermarket in the United States or in Europe or in a lot of these areas, but primarily in the US, you know, you can, in New York City, you can walk into a supermarket and buy food from anywhere.
Right.
And buy it pretty cheaply. And that's kind of crazy if you think about what it takes to get that to work. Now, it's also really inefficient for a number of reasons because the calories that we're producing, especially in the United States, are often not calories that are tailored for human consumption. Usually they're for animal consumption and animal feed or for processed foods, you know, corn, wheat, soy, staple crops. And so when you think about what we need to do as a society in the next 10 years, that is a really interesting efficiency problem. That is a problem that involves food waste and transportation and logistics and manufacturing and production and people and automation
this
and
is where
data.
The physics mindset
and this is where the physics mindset comes in. Where
okay,
you
so
sit
then
there.
It does make sense.
Yeah. And you sit there and you say, this is a big problem. Right. And a lot of people are going to fix things in this problem.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be one of those people.
When you first entered this space, right? So that conversation with your mom where you're like, I don't know crap about tomatoes. When you entered, what were maybe 2 to 3 things about farming that made you like, wow, I didn't even know this was a thing?
I honestly didn't know anything about farming. Really. I mean, my mother was a gardener. And so, you know, the thing that I remember the most about my mother's garden, and I remember the second we grew in our farms, was taste, right? This is a thing that everybody's pretty familiar with, which when you go to a farm or you pick something fresh and you eat it right away, the taste of a ripe fruit or a ripe vegetable off of a farm, there's nothing like it, right? There's nothing more enjoyable than a fresh produce item. And a lot of that is scientific in nature. The way that we have our industrialized food system, when you pick tomatoes in California or Mexico or Canada, and then they're shipped to New York City, by the time that we in New York City get these tomatoes, there actually are only a few varieties of tomatoes that are grown on commercial farms, and they're grown for transport. So they're rock hard, they're unripe, and they're gassed, and they're put on a truck, and then they're shipped to a supermarket in New York City.
Which is why I never liked tomatoes.
And nobody likes tomatoes. And that's why everybody says tomatoes are garbage, right? You know, you go to the grocery store and they taste like cardboard, is the comment that everybody gives. And one of the first things I learned was, what are the scientific processes involved in actually growing something for taste as opposed to transport, which is a fascinating thing, because you're thinking about shelf life and Brix content and sugar, you know, Brix sugar content, and all these different things that play a part, and how you can manipulate a system to get something that's a really good outcome for people is a very interesting thing. I think some of the other things you learn about farming right away that I had no idea. I don't know that anyone really understands the labor component to farming. And I think this is a hot topic now because of automation and the conversations around farm workers.
Right.
And automation.
So it's not necessarily human. It's labor as a whole.
It's a labor intensive system, from production through consumption. It's pretty labor intensive. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, the thing that I've been obsessed with most recently, is food safety and traceability. I think that, we, as consumers, really are disconnected from our food system in so many ways. And the idea, I don't know if anybody knows this, but if you scan a barcode, now with the iPhone, you can just do it natively. But if you scan a barcode of any item, a food item that has a barcode on it. So take a Clif Bar, right, and scan the barcode. You'll actually see this was produced by Clif Bar. This is a, you know, a Clif Bar peanut butter and chocolate bar. And it's this is the product and this is who made it. And I envision a future where consumers can scan a barcode and see, yes, and the peanuts came from this farm and they were picked on this date. And this is how many people touched it from seed through production. And that to me is like the holy grail is how much data can we share, and who cares about what data? Because nobody needs to see every piece of data. But traceability, I think people want to know.
I'm glad you brought that up, because just the other day I was commenting with a friend how I'm tired of people talking about blockchain for Bitcoin. And I'm like, guys, there's so much cooler stuff we can do, including food safety. I think there was one company who was trying to use blockchain to trace chickens.
Yeah, I just gave a talk about this, actually, about the blockchain and its applications in food safety. I mean, the challenge with blockchain is, and I'm by no means a blockchain expert. I don't think anybody is yet, except for like the three people who created blockchain. But the blockchain is really, it's really good for a ledger system that has a really long and complex and unknown supply chain. Food doesn't really have that.
An unknown supply chain?
Yeah. I mean, food, it really doesn't. If you think about like a farm, I know that my food is going somewhere. It's probably going to a distribution center and then a supermarket or distribution center and then a restaurant, or it's going direct to a restaurant. But each farm, you have a limited number of suppliers. It's not infinite. And so it's not like banking. It just isn't. It's not as complex as banking.
I guess I'm thinking of like the Uber processed food item that has like 60 inputs into it.
Yeah.
Right. That when I'm like, okay, I don't
know. Yeah. And that's that's where food gets scary. Right. And that's where, you know, we're in the fresh cut business. So we're only dealing with one item at a time.
Exactly.
But you deal with like, I think there's a researcher at the University of Minnesota who's amazing. I think her name is Amy Kirker. I'm going to get her last name wrong. But she gave a talk one time about how I think there's 80-something items in your average cheeseburger.
Yes.
Like 80 different supply chain items, supply chain processes in your cheeseburger.
I'm going to put the infographic
that we shared.
Yeah, I'm going to put that in the show notes.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I remember my brain just going, oh my goodness. Like, think about Think about this.
You think it's supposed to be just bread, meat, and cheese, but
I cook it at home, it's bread, meat, and cheese, but not, you know, not really.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to me, those processes. It's food is interesting, but yeah, the blockchain is definitely, it could be applied to food safety traceability. I think that would be pretty cool, but I think it's too slow of a technology right now. And
I think processing time is like 10 minutes.
I think. And so it's a little bit, and farmers just, I can't imagine them adopting the blockchain if they don't need to.
See, this is what I mean by like, we're already geek off on these topics. And the difficulty with this, when I was thinking about like how to boil down where in the food space we would talk about, is the fact that you've already mentioned like 12 different things a while ago, right? Logistics, labor, food safety. Yeah. When you were thinking of where AgriList would play in, how did you go about putting the stake in the ground? Did you say, all right, here are my skill sets, here are the gaps, where's the overlap? Or it was, what's the biggest problem? Let's find a way to fit that.
Yeah, so a little bit of the latter. It was a very nuanced problem that I was having as an operator, which was we don't have the tools to make decisions correctly. Mm. And as a result, we're losing revenue. And if we're losing revenue, everybody's losing revenue. And when you look at the system as a whole of farmers, especially in the indoor farming space, you know, a lot of people are giving hype to the yields and the profitability that you can get and these revenues, and they're throwing around really big numbers. And it's doable. It is definitely doable to get higher yields in an indoor facility than an outdoor, depending on the crop type. But if you compare as much of an apples to apples comparison as you can, which you can't really because it's different inputs and different growing systems. But if you look at, you know, lettuce in Salinas, California, it takes about 65 days to grow a head of lettuce in the summertime, 130-ish days in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. In an indoor facility, it takes anywhere between 18 and 33 days, depending on what variety you're growing year round.
Right.
So you're automatically getting about 4x the turns just annually.
By moving to an indoor system.
By moving to an indoor system. Right. You can do a million other things to increase efficiencies, but just from the shortening of the growth cycle alone because of no climate dependencies, you can already just off the bat have a higher revenue. But it's really capital intensive. It's really OpEx intensive. It's expensive to run these things, mm-hmm. and it's new enough that people don't know everything that they need to know yet and don't know what they don't know. Right?
Yeah.
This is like a huge problem. Yeah. And so when we, you know, we have customers now. So why we started AgriList, just to backtrack a second, is to help farmers become profitable. That's it. Super simple. Help farmers be profitable and operate at the best margins they can. That's it.
So when you say that though, are you implying that they weren't before?
Mm-hmm. We do an annual survey called the State of Indoor Farming, mm-hmm. and we're actually about to push out the new one, so we'll make sure that we can link as soon as that's ready.
Yeah.
It'll have every data point you ever wanted to know about indoor farming in it. But one of the things that we see is that of the farms that reported that they were profitable, they were also about 7 years old, right? So even if 100% of indoor farms are profitable, but it's 6-7 years to get there, that to me is a problem.
That's horrible.
And if I think about 10 years and how we feed people in urban populations and how we increase efficiencies and how we use less resources, indoor farming has to become a big component of that. And it has to be efficient and profitable. And for that to happen, farmers have to implement technologies, and they know that.
See, that's to me is surprising. I didn't know that, for one, because when I think about farming and food, it's so basic that you'd almost think they've got to be profitable.
No.
You know, before eating.
and these farms are more profitable than outdoor farms, right? If you look at the margins in traditional agriculture, I mean, it spans a lot of crops, but you can have any, you know, you're doing 2-4%. It's similar to the restaurant industry.
Sure, sure.
And here you can see maybe 20%, maybe.
Yeah.
If you're doing really well. And so you can get higher margins in an indoor farm.
It just seems weird that like the things that are fundamental to the human experience are less profitable for the stuff that like is cool and sexy nowadays, right? I think part of it is a mindset change, which is why I was a little bit intrigued when I was doing my prerequisite Google stalking, right? On your LinkedIn, you had written, focused on changing the way agriculture thinks. So I think this kind of feeds into that. How do you think it thinks now? And what would you like it to think? In what way do you want the agriculture space to be thinking about these issues of like feeding the world in the future? Like what exactly is the change that AgriList is hoping to see?
Yeah, I would think, you know, when I think about our customers and the people, you know, the farmers that we're working with, farmers mostly are thinking about survival right now. It's about how can I increase my revenue? Where can I cut costs? How do I maximize my output as much as possible? What we'd love to see is a system that espouses not just profitability, but is already profitable, and then can focus on things like higher nutritional content and wider variety of crop selection that can do more for people than just feed them, right? Think about the pharmaceutical benefits of crops and plants. And you can start to do a lot of things. There's a farm in Japan, actually, that's growing potassium-free lettuce because it's harder for people with kidney problems to process potassium. There's things like that that we can be doing, and we can be doing this at scale, but you can't do that until a farm is baseline profitable.
Basically, farmers today are doing like paycheck to paycheck.
And we see a system where it's about nutritional content and sustainability and food safety, and it's really beneficial to the people they're serving.
Yeah. So now if we talk about that as the mindset and your road to this, for the non-tech, non-food people out there, how would you then describe what Agrilis does?
So we are the thing that you would log into every day as a farmer to help you run your business. Everything from seeding a crop to moving it from one area to another to harvesting it to selling it. All of the data tied to that plant during that life cycle goes into AgriList, and then it tells you not only what to do every day, but how to improve.
Got you. So if we've, because I was looking at the website on the features that you have, right? Whether it's like the forecasting, the reporting dashboards you could do like the yields, right? But if you had to put that into buckets of the value, what value lies within Agrilist platform? Is it the fact that all your data is non-relational? Is it the fact that your farmer could potentially collaborate with his workers on the same platform? Like what would you say are like the 2 to 3 things that make it so valuable to farmers?
This is the first time that data lives in the digital world. So I'll say that first and foremost, because most of the time, if you're a farmer and you're running your farm, you're writing things down on paper. And so, you know, we had a farmer the other day who said, I want to get started. I don't really use that much software. You know, how can you help? And we said, how are you recording any of this information right now? And he sent us snapshots of a marble notebook, right? And so we took his handwritten notes and we transcribed them into digital. And then when you think about the magic, the value, the first thing it does is bring stability to your operation. So when you're writing things down on paper, think about a farmer who's doing this every day, but also has to forecast how much yield he's going to generate in 30 days. It's really, really hard to do that.
Yeah.
In our system, it does it automatically at a 90% accuracy rate. So that farmer logs in and knows exactly what he's going to produce today, tomorrow, and the next day for 30 more days.
Yeah.
It's just ability and knowledge of, I don't have to worry about anything. That's first and foremost what we care about. And then it's things like, how do you use your baseline data to actually improve revenue? So looking at things like space optimization in a farm or crop selection optimization, and then start to look at things like inventory management and cost cutting.
Yeah. So when you talk about all these numbers, by the way, and bringing stability, I for one can relate to that because I use the same approach with like personal life, right? Like sleep, optimizing your sleep, optimizing your diet. So I get that. Whereas on the flip side, when people talk about farming outside of this space, there's almost this like romantic ideal. I mean, there's the reason why the term farmer sexual came to be lately. But there's this like, oh, you know, they live off the land and they know how to do it without data.
Totally.
So when you mentioned the word magic, right, I really like that because I was reading your post on like lessons from 2 years of operating. How did you go about creating the initial seed of magic? Because I would assume that things like data and analytics, not every farmer might be able to talk about it the same way you do. So how did you go about creating that product that they would love?
I think the first thing, anytime you have a customer base who is innately focused on running a business and, you know, anything that they're investing in from a technology perspective has to do something for the business. So what you can start off by doing, and I said this before, but this is the first time that they're seeing their data that they're used to recording be valuable to them. And so what we did first and foremost was let's make it easy for somebody to get data in, and then let's show them how it can be valuable. And for us, that was the yield forecast, because that was a tool that every single farmer has to do.
What were they doing? How were they doing yield forecast before? Was it
either manual or not at all? So you're either taking that data that you've now written down on a marble notebook and putting it into Excel, and starting to think about what it might look like in 30 days.
Okay.
Or you're just not doing it. And a lot of times what we hear is, well, I just sort of go out and harvest what looks ready to go. Which, you know what, is a really rational thing for a grower to say, because they know their system. So if it looks ready to go, it's probably ready to go.
Right.
But imagine now if you could understand that in 30 days I'm going to have 100 pounds of butterhead lettuce, and now I can go out and pre-sell and make my life easier. That is magic.
But so they still define the initial metrics, though. The ROI, basically, they define that. Did you ever come into an issue where I always bring up this adage of, like, you know, Henry Ford, I don't know if this is like a real quote that he said, but he's like, you know, if people ask, if I ask
the horsepower,
people, if I ask people what they want, they would have just told me a faster horse. Did you ever come into that situation where?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this happens for anybody who's building something new for the first time, right? Yeah. So we have a lot of times where we'll work with customers, and I feel like everybody, you struggle with this for a little while and then you figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, you know, you have your first 5 customers, and they're probably the hardest, or your first 10 customers, I think, are your hardest 10 customers to get, right? And those 10 customers want, you know, well, I have this spreadsheet, so can't I just use this spreadsheet to get an outcome? And the answer is, you know what? Yeah, you can. Then that's what we started with. We said, yeah, the way that you're used to doing this, let's just do it better. Let's just do it better and faster and more accurate. And that's just getting more horses. But then you say, well, let's take the data that's coming in from your climate control system, which traditionally that data comes out in the form of pretty clunky graphs and things that aren't really usable other than its core function, which is turn lights on, turn lights off, turn vents on, turn vents off.
Because the data is siloed.
But this is the data and it's siloed. Gotcha. What if we could collect that data from this computer where it lives, pull it into AgriList, and now visualize how your lighting is driving yield changes in specific crops because of its location to a wall? What if we could do that? And then that begins to steer away from the horses, and you're saying, here's a vehicle, right? This is the thing for change. This is the thing that's going to change the way your business fundamentally operates.
Right. So rather than approaching them with, I don't know, some research article written at some university going like, hey, look at this new stuff. It's more like you were asking questions to get them to imagine.
Yeah, we always ask growers, we did this a lot more in the early days. We do it now to groups of growers, but we used to do it for every single grower that signed up. We said, what's your wish list? If you could run your business in the way that you dream about running your business, what does it look like? And then what we do is we peel apart that, and we physically ask them for that. We actually ask them to write that to us.
Yeah.
Or talk to us on a phone call about it. And then we take that list and we say, 60% of these things can be done with software. Let's build it for you.
Yeah.
And we try and collect, you know, as many of those lists as possible, and that becomes your feature list.
How then do you go addressing the issue when there's a point, you know, because I also work at a SaaS company where you now have so many clients, and sometimes those features that they're asking for are either way too specific to them, contradict someone else's, or you're just like, you know what, that's not really going to solve your problem. Yeah. How do you go about balancing that?
Yeah, then this is partly the Ford question, right? Yeah. Where users are notoriously bad at identifying the thing what they actually need.
Yeah, exactly.
They can identify their problem, but they can't identify what the solution is.
Yeah.
I mean, this happens all the time. For any software company that's dealing with this, you know, you deal with scope creep all the time, where, and it's really, really challenging to identify what is the problem that's going to work right now, or solution rather, what's the solution that's going to work right now, and what's the right solution. And so you have to do some fine balancing, and having good engineers is really what helps with that. And engineers who understand your customer. I think this is something that's really challenging, and sometimes it's really hard to do as a big company, but as a startup, you can do this pretty easily, where we make sure that every one of our engineers, actually every one of our teammates, goes to a customer's farm within 90 days and spends the day and learns how things are working, and not even the software side, just how does this farm operate? Because then what you can do is you can say, okay, you know, Joe just came to us and he's having this big problem. He can't figure out why he has some empty space in his farm, right? Mm-hmm. And he just wants to know why he has this empty space and how to fix it. Now, me as a farmer, my first reaction is I'm going to fill the empty space. But when you bring data and analytics in, what you can do is you can actually visualize that space over time and how it fills up. Mm-hmm. And Joe is actually in a greenhouse, and seasonality curves actually affect empty space because it takes faster or lower times to grow your crops. And so that empty space should not be filled because it's actually scheduled empty space for the growth cycle change that's about to occur, right? And there's these all these things that you can think about as an engineer. And then when you think about the solution, is it real-time space visualization? Is it real-time space visualization, or is it using machine learning to actually pre-program in your planting needs based on that space visualization? Like, there's whole types of things that are way more advanced than what I would do as a farmer, which is fill the empty space. So it's really a good matter of, you have to understand your customer base better than your customers understand themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really hard to do.
Yeah.
And you have to listen. I think a lot of it is be an active listener. Actually understand what the problem is. And don't try and engineer a solution to that problem today. Try and think about how you change the way that functionally works without over-engineering it.
Right. So by the way, for the listeners, if some of these terms are confusing, machine learning, data viz, don't worry. There will be links in the show notes.
Awesome.
This is going to be one of those shows. There's going to be a lot of links in the show notes. I think when you think about solving customer needs, it's a reason why I really enjoy conversations like this or bringing people on the show that have a different background. Because I think part of being able to solve an issue is having one foot outside of it.
Sure.
Right? And like, for example, applying engineering or applying physics mindset to it. For me, it's applying accounting to cooking. Are there other skill sets that you feel like, and I know I asked you this at the conference, like, are there other skill sets that you feel like are missing in the space right now?
Yeah, it's a really interesting space, actually, because when you think about indoor farming right now, you're probably thinking about the things that you read. If you're a tech-savvy reader and you're reading TechCrunch, you're reading about the Plentys of the world and the Bowerys of the world because they've raised a lot of money. If you're reading agricultural publications, you're reading about maybe the Tanimura and Antles or the Howlings out in Southern California because they're just conventional greenhouse companies that have just been crushing it for decades and decades and decades. Mm-hmm. So depending on what you're reading, you have this mindset of farming. And in the indoor farming space, you have this interesting chasm that's happening right now where there's a lot of tech companies starting to farm. And so you're having this merger of computer scientists and computer vision experts and data scientists and engineers and farmers and biologists and chemists all coming together. Mm-hmm. I think the next link is how we start to really start to bring in the engineers and the seeding, you know, the seeding folks, the folks that are dealing with the really heavy biological side and the chemistry. And you start to bring those folks together with the more soft science side, actually, with things like you think about the food safety and the bio and the physiological side of how food actually gets consumed. Coupled with the manufacturing mindset, if you can bring all those together, you've probably got a really interesting business.
Yeah, because that's basically what I'm getting at, right? If you're thinking of like the team you're trying to grow today, like who's missing on the table?
Well, I mean, we're missing a ton of people. We're actually actively hiring right now.
We will put that in the plug.
Yeah, we're hiring. I mean, we're primarily hiring folks on the sales side. And I mean, our team, if you think about it, is really two divots, right? We've got an engineering side and we've got a customer facing side. Mm-hmm. That being said, everybody is interacting together, which is one of the great things about our company. And so on the engineering side, what you're looking for is talent from software engineering, from data science, from visualization and UI UX design. Mm-hmm. And then on the customer side, you're thinking about sales folks and customer success and people who are on the marketing side. And you've got this whole sort of ensemble of people who care about data and farming and efficiency and building the tools to do it. So it's pretty interdisciplinary.
I think that's one thing that I keep wanting to emphasize to people is like, just because you're of one major or one experience doesn't mean it can't be applied elsewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I think that's one of, personally, that's one of the mistakes I made. I always thought, oh, I'm accounting. That's it.
I'm going to be an accountant.
I'm going to be an accountant. Doesn't matter if you're accounting for a company like Target or accounting for like a startup. It's just sure. accounting. Whereas thinking of things more as like mindsets.
Yeah.
That can be applied.
It's funny because that's, it, I mean, my mindset tends to be more vision focused, but mm-hmm. And so, which is funny because I'm also like this hugely data oriented and efficiencies person. But when I thought about physics, I never said to myself, "Great, I'm gonna go be a physicist now." Just wasn't gonna happen. Like it wasn't my thought. It was okay. I've got this cool fundamental background on problem solving, and also I can say I study physics, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it's so funny to me when people come interview with us. We've got, you know, our CTO created a record label.
Get out of here.
He created a record label. He even produced one of Gladys Knight's albums. Like, that's awesome. And totally unrelated to software engineering. Yeah. But it's a creative mindset, right? And engineers, a lot of times we see people coming from musical backgrounds or sometimes even food, like chefs turn software engineers. I think the creative mindset and the problem-solving mindset is hugely aligned with engineering. On the sales side, we have people who come from all kinds of backgrounds, from marketing turned salesperson mm-hmm. or, you know, our customers. If you think about the farmers that we're working with, some mm-hmm. of them come from the hospitality industry or were chefs and then wanted to produce or were accountants or were technical and just went, you know what, I'm going to farm now. We've got a customer in Florida who made a good amount of money in the manufacturing business. He just, you know, was in the manufacturing and logistics business.
Yeah.
And then he went and saw this farm, and the farm was run by, you know, a 6-year-old farmer, which, you know, in the US, the average age of farmers is 58 and a half-ish. Right, right. So, you know, 60 some odd farmer. And he said, this isn't working. This isn't, I'm seeing inefficiencies. And he bought the farm. Just bought the farm. Now he runs the farm.
What?
Yeah. And so you see people, I mean, this is, food tech is one of those industries and ag tech that I think people totally should look at their backgrounds as baseline and not rock solid.
Especially since there's so much shit we got to fix.
Yeah, totally.
I think a key takeaway for me when I'm hearing this is, you know, sometimes people will say like, oh, I'm just not a creative person or I'm not a problem solver. Whereas it should be more like, well, find activities because that'll train you to be, you know, it's a teachable skill.
Yeah.
Right.
We always ask in an interview, one of the questions we always ask is, we start with just tell me what you get out of bed for in the morning. What are you excited by that's not work related? Just tell me something that you really are excited about. And the funny thing is everyone has a passion.
Right.
And nobody's asked that in an interview because you're so nervous and you're thinking about, oh man, I'm so qualified for this job because X, Y, and Z, you know, because I studied whatever.
X, yeah, yeah.
And we ask, you know, what motivates you? Because that to us is probably way more critical than what you studied.
Because then you could figure out where their
skills. If you studied at all, by the way. Yeah. Because that to me teaches me how you think and what you like and how you're going to function in this atmosphere and what kind of teammate you're going to make and just those types of skills that, especially as a small team, make or break us.
True.
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us, do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
So I know we're reaching the half hour mark, so I'm going to actually pivot a bit. We talked about talent in this space. We talked about data and analytics, but I was reading an article the other day of how Amsterdam is one of these hotspots for indoor farming, right? I was looking at how much tomato they produce.
In the Netherlands,
compared to everybody else. Yeah. And I was just blown away. I'm like, this place is, I've been there. It's tiny.
Yeah.
Right?
You should link to the National Geographic article if that's what you're referencing. Yeah. Yep, it's a good article.
I actually printed it out because I was like, holy crap. and I was reading it and I was thinking, well, if this proves it can be done, what do you think is missing in the US ecosystem today that is a big challenge to why we can't do that today. Is it government support? Is it the talent piece? Is it, you know, what do you see as like your wish list? Like if we just had these three things, we'd be on a faster route to that future. Assuming that's the future we want to see, right?
Yeah. It's a great question. So I think the first thing to know about the Netherlands, this is not a new industry for the Netherlands. The mm-hmm. Netherlands has been committed to greenhouse growing for decades and decades. It's not new. If anybody studied economics, the tulip bubble, you should study the tulip bubble.
Yep.
Greenhouse growing. If you think about the leaders in greenhouse growing, it's the Netherlands. If you think about the leaders in greenhouse technology, it's the Netherlands. They've mm-hmm. got Wageningen University, which has one of the yep. best horticulture programs. It's just a powerhouse for this. And it's a teeny, teeny, teeny little region.
Yeah.
And they produce almost like, I don't even know what the percentage is, but they produce
they're second for pears.
A gazillion percent yeah. of the vegetables for Europe and for the world. And so, and that takes a lot of things. It takes a commitment from your government to saying this is something we want to be mm-hmm. number one in, and we want to be, you know, we want a good percentage of our GDP to be exporting produce. Great. Now we have to invest in greenhouse technology. It takes an understanding and knowledge and talent base. So you think about Wageningen University and having the foundation for now you've got the greatest horticultural pipeline of talent mm-hmm. coming out of you. Mm-hmm. You have to have the resources from a finance perspective, and you have to have the buyers, and you have to have the distribution network. I'd say four things.
Yeah.
And so in the United States, if you pivot to the United States, we have a government and a system that has focused so heavily on our agricultural economy being staple crops, corn, wheat, soy. And so if you think about if we as a society said, okay, no more, we don't want to do that anymore. We mm-hmm. want to do only greenhouse grown produce or only indoor farmed produce. That's fine. I don't know that that would be the right decision for the U.S. to do.
Right.
Because a good agricultural economy is sort of a combination of things that work really well.
That's suited for that region.
The region or the area. And so indoor farming certainly makes sense for certain crops in certain areas, of course. And so if you said, all right, let's shift 100% to now indoor production. That's all we're going to do, and we're going to be giant exporters. We're going to be the number one world's best exporter at mm-hmm. Tomatoes. That's great, but you need the government support because you need local municipalities to understand the permitting process. You need to have the land bank. You need to have we're missing the number two. You need to have the talent. So we need to be able to – we have great university programs actually in the United States in horticulture, Cornell in Arizona, Ohio State. You've got great horticultural programs in Arizona and Cornell, both in controlled environment, right? So you've got good programs, but they need to be – they need to be filtering out so many more people, right? Mm. You need to be churning out a high number of really skilled production people ready for production if you're going to do that. We need a financial system that's ready to invest.
Right. I think you were mentioning at the conference how a lot of people still don't understand the financial model behind mm-hmm. the farm.
Yeah. Well, we need banks, right? We need you know, the Wells Fargos, the Prudentials, the folks that are already investing in agriculture to commit and say, okay, we're going to invest in these systems, right? We're going to invest, not equity investments, but we need to invest in the farms. And they're already investing in farms, so they need to start investing heavily into indoor. And then you need the distribution network. Yeah. So you need the retailers to say, yes, we want this. This is where we want. Yeah, we're going to commit to that.
I guess it was a misleading question because I didn't mean to make it sound like the U.S. will mirror the same system that Netherlands is using, but more so...
No, but those are the macro things you need. Right. In any system to succeed, you need it to be able to operate and expand.
Yeah.
And those are the things you need for the space to do
this. Right, right. Well, it's basically like how do you get to a food system that actually fits and feeds the people that live there?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a misalignment in metrics because our metrics here have been maximizing the yield and reducing the cost. And
we've
never thought of maybe nutrition should be the metric, right?
That's a great question. Also a great question. But that depends on people's diets, where they live, how they buy. You know, that's a really good question that somebody is focusing on. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But if you think about the seed breeders, right? So think about seed breeding. It takes a long time to breed a new variety of crop. Mm-hmm. It takes, you know, 10 years to do a new variety of lettuce. It takes 15 to 20 years to do leeks or asparagus or carrots.
Yeah.
So it takes you know, a decade to do anything interesting on a breeding level.
Yeah.
So that's why things like CRISPR and all these things are really interesting technologies. But so let's just say, okay, it takes a decade to do a new lettuce variety. Well, we find out that the U.S. is really interested in snacking. Our urban population centers, you know, this is why the snacking tomato and the snacking carrot varieties have all come to market.
Yep.
Well, what's the thing that in 10 years U.S. citizens are going to be eating? That's a big question. You know, we know the macro trends, that there's going to be more of us. We know that we're going to be in urban populations.
Yep.
We know those things. But how are we going to eat? What are the health problems we're going to have in 10 years? Because we need breeders to think about that now.
Mm.
We need producers to think about how you build a system around those crops.
Yep.
And you need to start doing that now. And that's a way, that's yeah, a way more interesting. Yeah, because
there's a second layer of, like, even without the food production, there's media, right? Mm-hmm. Media can influence food.
Oh, totally.
So I'm not even going to go there.
And seeding companies, right? Like, seed companies can totally change the way we think about food.
Yeah.
And they have the power to do that, which is cool. But it has, you know,
There's risks and rewards.
It's great. And you have to balance that. And this is where, you know, I don't think we have enough time to get into things like GMOs and all the other things that
it's an episode two.
Yeah. So that everybody cares about. But that's where those types of things become a really interesting question, because we're going to have a lot of people. We're not going to have a lot of resources.
Right.
And we're going to have different health problems, and we're going to have different eating habits. And those questions can be answered by a system as a whole.
As a whole.
Not exactly. Just one player.
No, I appreciate that. The last interview I had was actually in Minnesota from this chef, the one who was a clinical psychologist. Mm. And he's like, we have to be talking about this. You know, the same people who are arguing that, oh, the Republicans are closed minded, the same people who are like, no to GMO and we won't even consider it. Like, we have to be considering this as a whole and not, you know, let's take the silo. So I'm reaching the 40-minute mark, and I know we said 40 minutes. Was there something I forgot to ask you before I get into some of these closing questions?
You know, one of the things I think is really interesting in the line of work we're in is how trends are different. I mean, we talked a lot about the U.S., but you've mentioned Netherlands and touched on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But how things are different in different countries.
Yes.
And the different challenges that people are facing. And one of the things, one of the pleasures that we have as a company is that we get to deal with all of them. And so it's really fun to think about, you know, if you think about China, one of the biggest challenges China has when it comes to food and food security is food safety.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that everybody is focused on solving in China. In the US, we're thinking a lot more about, you know, a lot less about food safety, but a lot more about sustainability and local and urban. And when you think about Canada and you think about the greenhouse industry in Canada, they're thinking about tomatoes,
yeah.
and cannabis, right? And you have cannabis as an industry, and you have all these different things popping up. And one of the really interesting things to think about over the next few years is how do companies and organizations and collaborations happen across country borders to solve some of these problems jointly. Because when you think about systems as a whole, I like to think a lot about how we can play a part, but also others can definitely play a part in thinking about these other challenges that other countries are having.
It's not like a monolithic, like, the food industry.
And they all affect everybody, right? You know, right. Chipotle and Blue Apron just lost senior executives over food safety outbreaks just recently, right?
Yep.
This is a thing that's happening here. It's not just in China. We should be, you know, FSMA hit and Food Safety Modernization Act.
Sorry.
Lingo. And so, you know, FSMA hit, and now growers are going to be faced with compliance with different food safety regulations. And so, you know, food safety is a huge issue for everyone. So is, you know, the volumes of production we need and sustainability.
Right.
So how we can sort of blur country lines and start to, you know, think as a whole, not just in the U.S., but globally is something that's really interesting.
Awesome. So two philosophical questions as I wrap this up. Someone once fired back on indoor farming philosophically, saying, you know, why are we even focusing our time on this? Because we could be solving the issues that we have on our traditional farms, the ones with the actual soil and the guy driving the tractor, right? Like, is indoor, you know, how would you respond to that, basically? That indoor farming perhaps is misguided, or we shouldn't even be
focusing. You know, first, I mean, I would ask that person why is that even a question they're asking, to be mm-hmm. honest? I mean, yeah, we should be fixing those problems. My thinking in this is, one, indoor farming is already an industry, right? We've had greenhouses for a really long time, and that National Geographic article on the Netherlands is actually a really good thing, because people can become aware of some of these technologies that have already existed mm-hmm. And existed for a long time. I'm guessing that they're probably mentioning that in relation to vertical farming and sort of the indoor fully enclosed, you know, soilless LED growing operations that are starting to come into play, mm-hmm. as opposed to maybe greenhouse, because even outdoor farms a lot of times have hoop houses and protected ag on top.
Right.
And so there's, I'll make that distinction first, but yeah, we should totally be fixing problems on conventional farms. I agree. That being said, if you think about the holistic system, think about the crops you want to grow in that system. And my answer would be, let's try and optimize for those crops. I would never tell somebody to grow corn, wheat, or soy in an indoor farm.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make economical sense.
Yeah.
Corn, wheat, and soy do really, really well in outdoor environments.
Right.
And it's really cheap to grow. And we've focused on that. We focus a lot of attention on fixing that problem, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, should we be giving, you know, should we be hooking John Deere tractors up to sensors and data software? Of course, totally. Yeah, yeah. Go for it. Definitely. Invest in those companies. Build those companies. It's great. Yeah,
perhaps it's more like it's a complementary solution than
mutually exactly. exclusive. And that's how I feel. And so, like, if you think about lettuce, right? I would ask, why grow lettuce outside? Lettuce is a short growth cycle crop that is physically a short crop that is highly perishable and has long supply chains. Why wouldn't you try to grow that closer to the point of consumption in an environment that it can thrive in? You know, that would be my question. And I've never been an advocate for every crop should be grown indoors. I don't think that's the solution. But trying to optimize for regional production and trying to figure out what the best solution for each crop is, I'm absolutely an advocate for that.
Basically, I asked that because of something you did bring up at the conference, which is like, there's no silver bullet. We have to look at this as
at all, a whole, right? This is a whole. I think a lot of people are trying to focus on different crops for indoor production, and I think that's great, but not everything is optimized for indoor production.
Right. The second thing was, you had written on Medium, I believe, and you had mentioned to me when we were speaking at the conference of like, okay, what's next for Agrilis? And you said growth. Now, I don't know if it's just maybe it's just me, but I sometimes, like, when I hear people talk about growth, I get this nagging sense of like, well, growth as a moral imperative, or growth for just growth's sake. Because you hear a lot of companies are like, growth, right?
And growth,
I
think above
a lot
all.
Of people a lot of people do agree that growth for growth's sake is pointless. Why do you believe Agrilis needs to grow? And the second part to that question is there a point where you say, we're good, we've done our job,
we've solved all the world's problems?
No.
That's a great question. I think, especially in the scheme of Silicon Valley right now, I think a lot of people are beginning to pay attention to, is growth above all the right thing?
Right.
And should we, you know, should companies care about profitability or not? Or, you know, what should people be thinking, especially venture-backed companies, right? And so when I say growth, why growth? One, we're a business. We want to grow. I think everybody should want to grow if you are a business. That growth doesn't have to be exponential, but, you know, we hope it is. But why grow is actually really core to the business. Our product at its core exists to make farmers' lives better, mm-hmm. right? And if you're going to do that, we win in that regard by collecting as much data as humanly possible, processing it as best as a data science team can,
right,
and then providing it back to our farmers in actionable insights.
Yeah.
We lose value to farmers if we have 10 farms and that's all we do, because we can't maximize the insight we can give to farms.
Yeah.
So when I think about growth, the more customers we have on the software, it's not just good for revenue for the business, it's good for the the data pool that becomes increasingly more valuable to the customer base. Mm-hmm. So when I think about our company's mission to help farmers, above all, help farmers, growth to me is grow as fast as we can, that's reasonable, to collect that data set so that we can continue providing more and more, more and more and more value right. back to those farmers.
Right. There's one last section that I had here, which is on every podcast, the rapid fire questions. I will ask them short, but it's up to you how long you want to take to answer them. First question, I usually say person who most influenced you from a cooking standpoint, but since you're of such a varied background, I will let you answer it as person who most influenced you from whatever you do today.
Person who most influenced me in whatever I do today.
Yeah, because I'm
Dr. Betty Young.
Oh, see, that was a quick answer.
Quick answer.
Who is Dr. Betty
Young? She was a professor of mine at Santa Clara University in physics and is just a crazy badass. Can I say that?
Yeah.
She's just a crazy badass.
Like I told you, there was someone who ranted here while drunk on gin.
So. No way.
Yeah, I'm serious.
She's one of the smartest women I've ever met and honestly is still a mentor to me.
Awesome. Yeah. Best data analytics tool you've ever purchased?
Best data analytics tool I've ever purchased. Right now, I actually just purchased Gecko Board.
Gecko Board.
Gecko Board.
Okay, what does that do?
This is a non-paid solicitation for Gecko Board. Gecko Board is a really simple piece of software, actually, that just allows you to aggregate data from any source and create dashboards. Okay. And it's just, it's really easy to use.
I might start using that for my daily habits.
It makes beautiful, beautiful dashboards that are really easy.
Everyone else who's a data geek on the show, listen to this. Best cooking tool you've ever purchased, not the knife.
It's funny because I just purchased a new set of knives. Best cooking tool, I just bought a Vitamix.
I can't get enough of my Vitamix.
I know. Another unpaid solicitation, but I love Vitamix.
I can't find anything that it cannot blend.
I know. I make a banana ice cream in it from bananas, frozen bananas, adding a little dulce de leche.
Yeah.
It is unreal and so easy. And I also make some tomato soup in it. It's just Vitamix. Vitamix all day.
So anyone who wants to know what my Christmas wish list is,
Vitamix. Can't get enough of it.
Three ingredients to describe you.
Three ingredients to describe me. You want quality traits or actual cooking ingredients?
Cooking ingredients.
Cooking ingredients. Okay. Yeah. Salt.
Okay.
This is a hard one. Salt. I'm going to say salt. Olive oil and garlic.
The basics.
The basics.
The basics.
The aromatics. No, I'm an Italian and a German, so anytime I cook anything, it has generally those. But I salt brings out flavor.
Yeah.
And I have no problem being flavorful. And olive oil, because you can make anything. And I feel like my skill set is generally pretty interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
And garlic, because it is the best thing in any form ever of all time.
Amen. I hate it when people just put two cloves of garlic in it. I'm like, dude, put the whole thing.
If you've ever been to Gilroy, anybody, there's an entire garlic festival that is pretty phenomenal. Garlic ice cream, garlic chips, great.
All the Filipinos out there, you know where to go. if you had to recommend one book or documentary or resource for the common person.
On this industry or in general?
In general. You're like, this is going to make you a better person.
I'll actually give two. One that I really recommend is actually on every person in this office's desk right now.
It's
Howard Resch's Hydroponic Food Production.
Okay.
This is an industry book. But it's essentially, the Bible for hydroponic growing. So if you ever were curious about growing at home or trying to create a system or anything related to this industry whatsoever, get the book. And the second I'll give a more general one is Raising the Bar. It's the story of the Cliff Bar. It's the story of the Cliff Bar team. And it's a really good book. And it just, as a founder, it's really interesting to hear stories that are different. Choosing not to take venture capital, even though you had it in front of you. Having this outdoors sort of focus and focus on nature and all these things. I love their story.
There's more than one way to the top, right? Last question. If you had to put all this work, all of Allison's work, into one tagline, what would that one line read?
One tagline.
And it doesn't have to be just about agrilis. This is like what gets you up in the morning, right?
Oh, man. Allison's tagline. Killing efficiency killers.
Killing efficiency killers.
Yeah.
Had we met like 10 years ago, we would have been like best friends.
That's the thing I get out of bed for. It's the thing I want to do more than anything.
Yeah,
it's just
like, Paulo, do you have to make everything efficient? I'm like, yeah, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Come to my house. It's weirdly efficient.
Awesome. I love it. I'm going to steal that one line. This one last one is more logistical. Where can people follow the story? Instagram, website, whatever.
Yeah,
this is your plug.
Yeah, totally. So we're on every social media channel. So you can, you know, our company is Agrylyst, AGRYLYST. We're on Instagram. I tweet probably more than the company tweets. So you can find me on Twitter at Allison Koff. And in terms of all the news that we want to share, go to our Medium, our blog on Medium.
Yep.
We try and share tidbits on just making the farm life easier.
Because you have two, right? You have one for the Agrylyst and one's yours.
Yeah, and most of the things I write are for the company. But yeah, I write way less than I'd love to. But you know, time.
And Koff is KOPF.
KOP as in Peter, F as in Frank.
Awesome.
Double L in Allison.
One day we're going to have the GMO talk or whatever other geeky stuff we could talk about. But yep. Today,
part two.
Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And we will see you soon.
Cool.